Welcome back. Those of you who were early risers may have recognised the Radio 4 theme used to start the channel's broadcasts for many years. Now I hope you're all settled back comfortably in your seats as we can now listen to Nigel's radio reminiscences.
I was formed, for better or worse, by so much of this revolution by radio. So what were my beginnings? I was brought up, really, by my grandparents. So there was a huge gap, certainly emotionally, that was filled with imaginative experiences from reading, of course, but especially from the radio. First, there was humour. Much of it was an early antidote to the experience of war. My childhood was punctuated by catchphrases that somehow gave a sense of connection and security. Can I do you now, sir? As well as that huge variety of voice, there seemed to be a standard BBC voice in relation to which many local accents were diminished. However, to balance that, we now had access to entertainment which up till then had been almost entirely local and homespun. The high peak might have been some worthy's wife playing a cello in the church hall. And now, suddenly, anything that could be heard could be transmitted. Music directly from the concert halls. The first broadcast prom concert featured Rossini's William Tell Overture. Sir Henry Wood conducted and released a statement. He said, "With the wholehearted support of the wonderful medium of broadcasting, I feel I am at last on the threshold of realizing my lifelong ambition of truly democratizing the message of music and making its beneficent effect universal." I didn't hear that, of course, but heard subsequently so much music that literally enriched my soul. Thanks to Radio 3, I listened to wonderful music. But while classical music was crucial, it was just one part of the mix. I heard Neville Coggill read Chaucer in medieval English. One at Aprile with his shore asochter, the drocht o merch y persi to the rota, and bathed every vine in switch liqueur, of which vertu engendered is the flour. And listened avidly to several Shakespeare plays. I was introduced to Dylan Thomas as a poet, and to Undermilk Wood as an experience in sound.
To begin at the beginning. It is spring, moonless night in the small town, starless and Bible black. The cobble streets silent and the hunched quarters and rabbits wood limping invisible down to the slow black, crow black, fishing boat bobbing sea.
Alan Lomax took me on a journey through the southern states of America, and all this was interspersed with daily and vicarious thrills from the light program offered by Dick Barton's special agent with his partners in cliff-hanging crime-fighting, the partners being Jock and Snowy. There was jazz and poetry, Alan Brown John, Brian Jones, Danny Adsey, who all of whom later became friends, Anthony Thwaites, Ted Hughes and Tom Gunn. These were all first heard on the third program, easily fulfilling Sir William Haley's insistence that it would seek every evening to do something that is culturally satisfying and significant. I heard plays for the first time by Samuel Beckett, Harold Pinter, Joe Orton. And through all that, together with the listener, I visited in my mind intellectual arenas I had never knew I might eventually come to like. Drama registered with particular impact, where the stage is set in the mind of the audience as the listener absorbs the power and the tune of the emerging voices.
Thank you, Nigel. Well, I think most of you would agree that radio drama can be particularly, well, dramatic. You didn't necessarily need to be sitting down throughout. On several occasions, my arm, or decorating paintbrush, would be stilled in mid-stroke at an especially gripping part of a drama, or speeded up during a high action scene. Pam, can you give us an insight into behind the scenes?
Right, Jenny. Well, the very first radio play, entitled Danger, was written just to fill a gap in the schedule. Here's some background information.
It was Richard Hughes who was asked by the British Broadcasting Company, as it then was, in January 1924, to write a play for effect by sound only in the same way that film plays at that time were written for effect by sight only. This play, Danger, thus became the first listening play, an experiment in a new medium which has since been considerably developed. It was first broadcast from the London station of the British Broadcasting Company on January 15, 1924.
And here's the playwright himself, Richard Hughes, reporting a conversation over dinner with Sir Nigel Playfair, theatre entrepreneur and the BBC producer.
He then said, well, of course, really, this is an entirely new medium and really needs something written specially for it. I said, I couldn't agree more. He said, well, awful pity it isn't time to ask you to do something for it. I said, what do you mean there isn't time? He said, I've got to take my programme into the BBC Savoy Hill lunchtime tomorrow. And so I said, well, let me have a try. I sat up all night, wrote the play and took it to him at breakfast. And I argued to myself like this. There'd never been before anything which people had had to take in by their ears only, anything dramatic, I mean. So it occurred to me that obviously the best thing was to choose a theme which would happen entirely in the dark. And an accident in a coal mine suggested itself. And that's how it came that I wrote this play, beginning with the lines, the lights have gone out, hoping that everybody would listen in the dark and get the feeling of the darkness that way.
Am I right in believing that on the very first broadcast, the announcer who presented the play asked the listeners to turn out their lights when they were listening?
Yes, he did.
Groundbreaking stuff. And he wrote it overnight. Unfortunately, it was a one-off solution. Not every play could be set down a coal mine after a collapse. But as more plays were adapted and written especially for radio, they realised this was not a problem at all. As someone, possibly Alasdair Cook, said, the sets are so much better on radio. I've done lots of radio plays and I love it. It's a truly creative medium. Let me describe to you a typical radio drama studio. You enter through two sets of heavy soundproof doors into a big cube-shaped room. The air is still, and you become aware of the total lack of any outside noise. The walls are covered in giant foam egg boxes. Half the floor is carpeted and half is wooden. Running along one wall is a staircase leading up to nowhere. Each step is divided in three, one part carpet, one part wood, and one part stone. So you can come downstairs from a domestic bedroom, or a warehouse loft, or descend from the battlements. In one corner is a working sink with mismatched china and cutlery. Chairs and tables are scattered randomly between five or six big acoustic baffles, heavy padded sections of wall on wheels. But the most bizarre are the doors. Several kinds of doors, thin doors, thick doors, all on solid, slammable frames with heavy-duty casters. One of the more surreal things you might do is knock on one of these doors and be welcomed in by another actor, both of you somehow editing out the fact that you could quite easily walk round the side. There are shallow metal trays for footsteps, one of gravel, one of sand, and one of scrunched up old magnetic sound tape, a good fake for autumn leaves. Occasionally, there's a hammer and a very battered cabbage left over from a gruesome murder. Only two people are needed behind the glass in the control room, the director and the studio manager. He does all the technical work and organises the props and sound effects, like cold water in the teapot. Tinned peaches substitute for most kinds of foods as they sound good and don't dry your mouth out. More tea, Vicar, perhaps another crumpet. Love scenes on radio can be dangerously hilarious. Kisses are usually done by the actor on their own arm. Slobbering away on yourself, turning a page silently, and staying close to the mic can make for some very odd positions. I hope all this info hasn't spoiled your enjoyment, because compared with other media, radio is remarkably light in its technical demands. In the theatre, rehearsals take weeks. In film and TV, even a small scene can take days to shoot. But in radio, the transition from page to final result is almost instant. So radio can capture the exact moment of creative discovery better than any other medium. And for the listener, it's a rare chance to exercise their imagination, which, after all, is one of the things that make us human. And yes, the sets are better and much cheaper.
Thank you, Pam. What an insight into the hard work that the listener takes for granted. Now, Trevor has some more tunes for you to guess.
Thanks, Jenny. Time to dig into the memory banks again. Here's the first theme tune, which is from way back. Reg was straight in there. Paul Temple, an early radio thriller series running from 1938, so you must have been there at the beginning, Reg, to 1950. The theme tune was called Coronation Scott. Right, brace yourselves.
Wakey wake!
From 1949 to 1968, another Sunday lunchtime fixture. The star singers with the band were Alan Breeze and Kathy Kay. And Billy Cotton's signature tune was Somebody Stole My Gal. Right, here's the next. Any offers? Down Your Way indeed, rather more gentle than Billy Cotton. It ran between December 46 and 1992 on Sunday afternoons, and Down Your Way visited various parts of the UK with locals choosing their favourite music. Richard Dimbleby, Brian Johnston and Franklin Engelman were the various hosts. Now surely everyone will know the next one. You'll get the impression that we like the antidote to panel games. I'm sorry I haven't a clue. Started in 1972 and still going strong. Humphrey Littleton and Samantha hosted it till Hump's death in 2007. And as Derek said earlier, Jack D is now in the chair. What about this one? Hancock's Half Hour, Tales from 23 Railway Cuttings Cheam. It ran for 63 episodes between 1954 and 1961, and then went on to television. Written by Ray Galton and Alan Simpson, it starred Tony Hancock, Sid James, and the wonderful Hattie Jakes. And finally... Great. Somebody got it. Not in town tonight, although it's not a million miles away, actually. Music while you work. Very much part of the war effort when it started in 1940. It provided continuous music twice a day, each for half an hour. After a while, it just moved to a morning slot and finished completely in September 1967. Not surprisingly, the theme tune was called Calling All Workers.
Thank you, Trevor. Another programme which had a memorable theme tune was The Navy Lark, a very popular comic series which was first broadcast on Sunday the 28th of March 1959 at 7 p.m. on the BBC Light programme. This, supposedly, is how it came about.
Come in. Oh, come in, Laurie. You mentioned on the phone something about an idea for a new show.
Yes, I bumped into John Pertwee last week.
Before you go any further, the days of one-star comic shows are over.
You mean we've got to find a team?
Exactly. Something good one, too.
Well, I was going to suggest that we use John as an actor, not as a comedian.
Yes. And put an actor like Dennis Price. Sort of bloke who can put over a good, believable, funny story.
Oh, Dennis would be absolutely wonderful.
Well, that's two. The rough and the polish, that balances. Now we want a third.
What about a plot? That'd be handy.
You know, I've had a feeling for quite a while now that the time's right for services show.
Services show? Oh, I thought we'd had all that.
Oh, don't misunderstand me, Laurie. I mean a good storyline show about a service unit, not a string of service jokes.
Ah, that's better.
Now, what I want are absolutely believable stories about an army camp...
Hang on. The army's been pretty well flogged. Why not the Air Force for a change?
Why the Air Force?
Well, I was in it for one thing.
Well, I was in the Army.
That settles it then. We'll make it the Navy.
A bit tricky, you know. They don't allow women on board.
Well, if they're lookout, they shouldn't have joined in the first... Oh, yeah, I see what you mean. Well, that's simple. We won't put them on board. We'll make it a shore station. Say, an island.
Just close enough to Portsmouth for the CNC to be able to keep an eye on them.
Yes. John Pertwee will be the Chief Petty Officer.
In charge of the stores, or such stores as are left after he's got at them.
Dennis Price is the number one, of course, trying to keep his tabs on what's going on. What we need now is a sub-lieutenant.
Yes.
Preferably a sort of terribly keen and energetic dead loss.
Leslie Phillips.
Marvellous. He's the most perfect dead loss in the business.
He's a wonderful guy, too. This could work, Laurie. Dennis Price, John Pertwee, Leslie Phillips. Solid team. Well balanced. What about a title?
Oh, I hate finding titles. The Navy Shower.
Cheap and music hall-y.
Navy Life. Lot. Lark.
What was that?
The Navy Lark.
Not bad.
I set for that.
So would I. Well, don't just sit there. Go and get writing the thing. The script is going to be the real star of this, and it's got to be good, interesting, and funny.
And I just quit.
No, you didn't. What's today? Friday. I want the first Navy Lark on my desk on Wednesday morning, and I'll have Dennis Price, John Pertwee, and Leslie Phillips in the office to see how it sounds. Get writing, lad. Can I, lend you a pencil?
Well, as technology developed, it became possible to include the listeners. These days, there are many radio programmes which feature phone-ins, and it's usual for presenters or reporters to go out to get interviews from the public in person. Elam has featured in several such productions. Trevor, you were closely involved in one.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, Jenny. This is very much another personal memory. In the mid-1980s, I was chair of the Old Village Hall Committee fundraising team. One heady evening, we decided to set our sights higher than the conventional fundraising activities, and have, over 14 days, an Elam festival that would put our village on the map. I bashed off letters to a number of institutions that were probably way above our station. One was to the Army that resulted in the Royal Irish Rangers Band marching in the square one Sunday afternoon. Another went to Radio Kent, who ended up broadcasting for an entire Saturday morning from the festival market in the square. A further letter went to Carol Stone at the BBC, who at the time was producer of Any Questions, a Friday night Radio 4 institution. I invited her to bring the programme to Elam Village Hall. This question and answer session toured the country each week. At the time, it was chaired by John Timpson, and a panel of four national figures answered questions from local residents. It continues to this day. Nobody was more surprised than me to get a phone call from Carol a few weeks later saying that she would indeed like to bring the programme to Elam. Preparations went well and excitement mounted. However, I was even more surprised when I received a phone call about 10 days before the broadcast date to tell me the panel that had been selected. It was amazingly heavyweight. John Smith, soon to be leader of the Labour Party, Paddy Ashdown, leader-elect of the Liberal Party, Kenneth Baker, Secretary of State for Education, and Joan Burrell, at the time UK Businesswoman of the Year. On the evening, the village hall was packed as the chairman, John Timpson, welcomed the Radio 4 audience to Elam and described the village as...
trap for the unwary broadcaster, since it is spelt Elam, and I fell into it last week. But in medieval times, when it was an important market town, they caught eels in the local stream here. The market has long since gone. The stream appears only occasionally, I gather, but the eels of Elam live on in the name. We are the guests of the Village Hall Association.
A range of questions had been submitted, and one was from a local luminary.
Let's have the next question, please.
Ken London. This area of Kent looks destined to host one of the world's most exciting civil engineering projects, the Channel Tunnel. Travellers will still be able to reach most European capitals quicker by air. Do the panel see any real benefit in such an expensive project, and would they be prepared to travel along a 20-mile enclosed tube?
Thank you.
A popular question. For me, there was a very special moment in the evening. It was the form that before the broadcast, the panellists were entertained to dinner. Off they went to the Abbot's fireside. When they returned to the village hall, there was still 15 minutes or so till broadcast, and John Timpson was warming the audience up. It was a glorious summer evening, and rather than sit in the somewhat cosy committee room, I suggested that we went outside. Thus, I sat with four eminent national figures in the corner of John Palmer's cornfield at the rear of the village hall, where the sports centre is now, putting the world right. Quite a surreal moment, and for me, the highlight of a memorable evening.
Thank you, Trevor. Derek, you were involved in another broadcast from Elam.
Yes, on the 3rd of September 1989, the 50th anniversary of the outbreak of World War II, Derek Jameson's Radio 2 breakfast programme was broadcast live from various locations in and around Elam. It started with Neville Chamberlain's famous broadcast.
This is London. You will now hear a statement by the Prime Minister. I am speaking to you from the Cabinet Room at 10 Downing Street. This morning, the British Ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock, that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war would exist between us. I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently this country is at war with Germany.
Mary Smith at King Post, the former post office, recalled that as she listened to that broadcast, she was standing outside the back door, shaking dry lettuce that she had washed. And it was that mix of the everyday and the apocalyptic that led her 1940 diary becoming the basis for a book and the spur for the Jameson programme. He interviewed an American airman who had fought with the RAF, a guy from the Kent Battle of Britain Museum, and various village folk, including John Palmer, Lillian Wooden, whose father had been in the Home Guard, and me. Those interviews, except mine, all survive. But let's just listen to that with Miss Smith, who taught English and Latin to generations of boys at Simon Langton from 1940 until her retirement in 1969.
So there we are, dogfights raging in the skies over Kent with the village of Elam right in the thick of it where I am now. But what was life like for the people there, the villagers? Of course, it went on very much as usual. The centre of communication for the village was the post office, and Mary Smith was the daughter of the postmaster and indeed the chairman of the parish council, Edward Smith, and she vividly remembers those wartime years. Good morning to you, Mary.
Good morning.
Of course, you've been a teacher for all those years,
haven't
you?
Oh, yes, I have, yes, all that time.
In Canterbury?
Yes, I was teaching at the Simon Langton Boys' School at Canterbury, you see, for most of the wartime. But, of course, I saw all the Elam background as well.
Wonderful. Mary, you kept me awake half the night because your wartime diary was turned into a famous book called Harvest of Messerschmitt, can't say that word, by Dennis Knight.
Yes.
And, of course, the great thing about your diary was that, of course, it recorded weddings, gardening, the cat, going out shopping, going to the pictures and all that sort of thing. You recorded life as it was in those days.
Absolutely. I just wrote down, you know, every day, just a tiny little bit of everyday occurrences and, of course, all that was going on overhead. I'm a very unmethodical person, but I did write down the times of various air raids and when certain paratroops came
indeed
down, that sort of thing.
And even of course, registered, if you could, the names of the poor men who died there.
When I could, yes, but not always. Sometimes I
could. What was it like to go outdoors and there would be gunfire, bombs, smoke?
Well, we didn't worry very much. We didn't want to miss any of the fun. That was half the tour, really. You know, my father used to nip out across into the square and drag in anybody into the post office who was wandering about, that kind of thing.
So people weren't panic-stricken or anything like that?
Not a bit. There was a lot of humour at the time, ever such a lot of humour. And that kept us all going, I think. Really.
And had all the children been evacuated, being so close to the coast?
What, from Elam? Mm. No, hardly anybody.
They went from Dover and Folkestone.
Yes, and from Canterbury, they had the chance to be evacuated, but many of them didn't want to. They didn't want to miss what was going on.
Now, with your father being the postmaster, this chair where I sit has a very historic importance, doesn't it?
Oh, yes. One evening, it was in August 1940, I was hanging out the windows here watching an air battle over Hawkinge. It was a pretty bloody battle, and I was rather annoyed because the commentators were treating it like a football match, which I didn't think was the right attitude at all when men were being killed on either side. Meanwhile, my father was in here, and there was a knock at the door, and there was this tall, good-looking man, I think he was 42, was slightly greying at the temples, wearing a white shirt, grey flannel trousers, and white shoes, and he'd just been interrupted in a game of tennis up on the hills at Park Gate, where he was staying. He came to the door and said to my father, I must use your telephone, because I've got to get through to Whitehall, and the telephone where I'm staying is out of order. So, of course, we all made ourselves scarce, and he sat on that very chair and went through on business of state. But my mother always used to keep a bunch of marigolds on that table, beautiful ones, and she was so fed up because that very night when Anthony Eden sat here, the marigolds had faded. would be the case.
Yes, that it? Was, of course, Mr. Anthony Eden, who was the Secretary of State for War and Churchill's chief lieutenant,
right.
Later became Foreign Secretary. So he wasn't wearing his famous Homburg hat on that occasion.
Oh, Lord, no.
People's memories are what give history its human depth. Nigel has shared some memories of his experience of radio during World War II and beyond.
The war met me on the beach at Benslick on Anglesey. I was 5. A limping, bespectacled gentleman was taking the sea air, and he was Derek McCulloch, otherwise known as Uncle Mac. The BBC Radio Variety Department had been diverted to Bangor, in North Wales. My first wireless recollection of the BBC at war was the D-Day and the voice of Winfred Vaughan Thomas shaping the pictures. Till then I had been up in Anglesey where the main preoccupation seemed to be German spies spotting the convoys into Liverpool and who next was skipping across to Dublin to bring home the sausages. Kent was different. I was older. Canterbury had been blitzed, and the radio was used to hold the community together. Programmes were angled to maintain morale and insist that Britain could take it. Germany had to be diminished, its propaganda ridiculed. Do you remember Lord Haw-Haw?
Germany calling, Germany calling, Germany calling.
We were warned about loose talk, but mainly enabled to keep cheerful and confident. There was much separation among families and huge worries about relatives in the forces, and the BBC radio helped to fill the gap. Forces favourites, patriotic songs, and a vigorous projection of the shared sacrifices and also the projection of family values that we were fighting for. And there was the action. I said I remembered D-Day and then Arnhem and the attacks on the Rhine as key moments, outside broadcasts on a grand scale. And after that, the images became visual. I was taken to the cinema and the newsreels gave me another dimension. But it was perhaps a blessing, because I remember leaving the cinema after seeing a newsreel about the conditions in Belsen. It was so shocking, in some juvenile way, I knew I did not have the moral capacity to come to terms with it. But at least the images were finite and really belonged to others. If they had been entirely the product of words working on my imagination, they might have been impossible to control at that age, which shows the power of radio to work on the imagination.
Thank you, Nigel. Very powerful stuff indeed. And now for something completely different. Get guessing. Here's Trevor with some more famous voices for you.
Thanks, Jenny. Now, these voices are from slightly more recent times. We start with one that I'm sure will be very familiar.
So, teams, while Samantha nips out to warm up her little Morris, I'd like you please to come up with some titles of films likely to be popular with the motor trade.
He's very... Oh, good. I thought everyone had dozed off. Humphrey Littleton, indeed. Mm. Now, Humph was a very accomplished jazz musician and band leader before he became the unlikely chairman of I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue in 1972 and introduced an unsuspecting world to Samantha. Here's another.
I'll tell you a tale of the B-Blads, where they play all the latest hits. And that harsh rending sound you can hear from the ground is the DG performing the splits. Yes, he's up on the roof keeping fit, lads. While most are just taking a rest, he's cavorting about, disregarding his gout in a filthy old anchor-like vest.
Not Eamon Andrews, but Terry Wogan. A stalwart of Radio 1 and Radio 2, perhaps most well known for Wake Up to Wogan, which ran between 1993 and 2009. He was also the BBC's irreverent stalwart of the Eurovision Song Contest. Now, this one is a little bit more obscure.
Indian police are holding a pigeon under armed guard because they suspect it's been on a spying mission for Pakistan.
Anyone want to hazard a guess? If you listened to Radio 4 over the years, you will have heard him on many occasions. Peter Donaldson started on Radio 4 in 1975. He was a continuity announcer, a newsreader, and skilled presenter of the shipping forecast. And finally, he became chief announcer, which he was at the time of his death in 2015. Now, what about this one?
Also finding out why school children, it would appear, seem to be having chips with everything during their dinner break, you may well say, what's new? The sinking of the Belgrano, we hope to be going through the events as they happened during the Falklands War, and the miners' dispute. Is the gap between the miners and the coal board really bridgeable, as the General Secretary of the TUC is saying it is? Well,
indeed, Jimmy Young. A famous singer in the 1950s, with hits such as Unchained Melody and The Man from Laramie, he then went on to become a DJ at Radio Luxembourg and eventually moved to Radio 2. He presented the morning show on Radio 2 for nearly 30 years. The Jimmy Young Show was a mix of music and current affairs, and it was notable, particularly at the time, for the fact that he called all interviewees by their Christian name. Right, here's another.
I can't begin to tell you how many times I've been walking down the street, minding my own business, pottering along on my bike, or simply sitting in a queue of traffic at the wheel of my Mini, when, apropos of absolutely nothing, I've heard that cow.
Anyone want to hazard a guess? Jenny Murray, indeed. The presenter of A Woman's Hour from 1987 until 2020. A journalist and broadcaster, and less widely known, patron of the Family Planning Association. And now, sadly, our last voice.
And very alive and right beside me now is Robin Gibb. Robin, has your severance from the Bee Gees had any effect that you're aware of yourself on your composing activities?
Brian Matthew, indeed. Thank you very much. Amazingly, Brian Matthew was at the BBC from 1954 until 2017. As I said earlier, he presented Saturday Club in Easy Beat on Saturday and Sunday mornings on the Light programme during the 1960s. Then appropriately, he was presenter of Sounds of the 60s on Radio 2 from 1990 until his death in 2017. So that's it. Thank you, everybody, for joining in so enthusiastically. Now over to Pam.
Thanks, Trevor. Music maestro, please. Yes, it's Barwick Green, the unmistakable intro to an everyday story of country folk, The Archers. It began with just 5 pilot episodes in 1950 and is still going strong. Here's an early clip of Dan and Doris.
Oh, by the way, did you see that representative, Dan? I sent him out to you on the top field. Fertilizer, wasn't it?
That's it. It reminded me to order right away and get me rebate.
And did you?
Of course. Should have been a mug if I didn't. I must remember to check with Phil that he's ordered. While he's slipped his mind with this weekend he's just taken. And I don't know, some folks can do it all right. Only wish I could take a weekend off when I feel like it.
Well, so you could if you didn't get rid of your best worker.
That subject's closed. And I didn't get rid of him. For the 100th time, he got rid of himself.
That was Harry Oakes and Gwen Berryman. And here's me old pal, me old beauty, Walter Gabriel, played by Chris Giddens.
Oh, meaning to the lot of you. I never meant such a crowd of folks for running other people's affairs. Never.
Oh, that got him rattled, comrade. He nibbled at that all right, poor old MP. Dirty work, Dan, they called him.
That voice was so familiar in my house, I thought he was a relative. So many memorable moments, a long list of distinguished guests, visits from Princess Margaret, Dame Edna Everidge, Annika Rice, Bradley Wiggins, and just last month, breaking all records, June Spencer, who played Peggy Woolley, retired at the age of 103. And all those storylines. There was Nigel Pargeter's fall, the Grundys, the Snells. It's impossible to do it justice. There have been over 19,500 episodes. But the most famous event of all would be the dramatic death of Grace Archer. Phil and Grace are having a quiet dinner in the Bull with John and Carol Tregoran when...
Help!
Hello, what's up, Grace?
What? Oh, heavens, Grace. No, lots of blaze. Hey? Come on, quickly. Help me with the horses.
Look, Grace, the horses are going up. Look, what's all the commotion? Fire, Reggie. The stables are going up. Now ring for the fire brigade straight away, will you? Right away.
They all rush outside.
It's an inferno in there. They should be as dry as a tinder. Come on, get well away.
Midnight! Midnight!
Woo! Oh, my gosh, we're not going to get him out.
Yes, certainly were.
What's up?
Midnight couldn't have been tighter. Look, she's going back into the stable.
What? No, Grace! No, don't do it!
She's going in after midnight.
Grace, come back! The roof's collapsing! For God's sake, Grace, come back!
Look at that roof! It's caving.
Horrible!
Phil, you fool!
Let me go! Grace is in there! Let me go, blast it, John!
Now, look, Phil, it's suicide if you go in.
Grace!
Phil, you madman!
Don't let him!
The nation mourned. Powerful stuff. Mm. Not all of it was high drama. Here's more of an everyday scene.
What are you scratching about it out here?
Weeding the path, and a thankless job it is too. No matter how much you do it, it never looks tidy.
It's all right to me.
It ought to. I've spent about a couple of hours doing 3 yards. You know, I think I'll have crazy paving here.
Eh?
At least it won't be such a back-breaking job getting the weeds out. Yes, I've been thinking about it for most of the summer. We'll have crazy paving. No, not the original actors. That was John Culshaw as Dan. And guess who? Me, as Doris, in a play called Dead Girls Tell No Tales. It was brave of the Archers team to reveal that the broadcasting of Grace's death on the 22nd of September, 1955, the very same night as the launch of ITV, was no coincidence but an early skirmish in the broadcasting wars. Izan Churchman, who played Grace, and who incidentally had been pushing for equal pay, was the sacrifice. Two birds with one stone, maybe. The Archers is now broadcast all over the world, and other countries have created their own everyday tales of country folk. Although here the subtitle has been updated to A Contemporary Drama in a Rural Setting. Long may it prosper.
Thank you, Pam. Well, as a real rural community with an attractive village centre, Elam has gained the attention of quite a few broadcasts over the years. One was A Year in the Country, and Derek can tell us more about it.
Michael Hayes had a long career in theatre and television as actor and director. Previously a Lymings resident, by 1992 he was living at 5 Prospect Terrace and working for the BBC World Service Radio. Throughout that year he made 12 quarter-hour programmes under the title A Year in the Country. They were an eclectic mix reflecting Michael's broad range of interests, but mainly concerned with the work and leisure as seen in the Elam Valley, though with visits to Howlett's and Port Lim to share the wisdom of John Aspinall, and to Boughton-under-Bleane to look at the growing of hops. But the hub of the programme was the public bar of the King's Arms, where Michael would be found at lunchtime with Dougal, his Springer Spaniel, after a night on duty at Bush House. In the following extract, Michael reflects on the climate of the Elam Valley and the harsh winters that used to be the norm. We hear the voices of Bert Want, who delivered bread for Horace Cook, and of Vernon Blackford.
The Elam Valley, where I've lived for the last 25 years, runs very roughly north to south, from Canterbury to Folkestone, in fact, so that when the wind's in the right quarter, or rather the wrong quarter, there's not much between us and the North Pole except Margate Town Hall, and that's 30 miles away. And where there's a bend in the valley, the north-facing slopes can hold their carpet of snow for weeks, long after everywhere else is clear. And the Kentish lanes don't help much. Being worn down through the soft chalk, they're often sunken between banks more than 12 feet deep. That's a lot of snow. A few years ago, I tried to dig out a way for the horses to their paddock. I gave up after about 30 minutes and 10 feet of progress, and that was in March. Yes, in this valley, we know all about snow.
Snowed in? Well, we always got snowed in, didn't we, years ago? We never. No road was open. Well, we had a butcher's van. Remember, Alec, where Ben was, bare forces was snowed in there for a week before they got it out. Before they dug it out, they had to dig it out.
Dug it out, didn't they?
Yeah. Oh, they are.
Yes. I remember my own experience as a Saturday boy on the Acres Swingfield Denton Bread Round in 1956. 3 weeks running, we had to go via Folkestone as no hill out of the valley was open. Michael spoke to George Palmer in several programmes, both as farmer and chairman of the parish council. In June, it was about footpaths.
George Palmer at Parsonage Farm is happy to have people on his land, but, and there is a but.
I'm not against them at all. I'm quite liking to enjoy the countryside. It is the ones that exercise their rights that always raise the hackles on the back of my neck. Because the footpaths were created by men, women and children that lived, worked in the countryside 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year. They had no need of leisure paths. All they wanted was the quickest route to and from their home, to their work, to their shops, to their church, to their pub, to their school. And when they went out, they looked for the straightest route they could find. If it was rough grazing and pasture land, they went caterways across it. If it was arable, they kept to the foragers, because they wouldn't want to trample down the crop, because they was going to have to actually live off that crop. If they trampled down wheat, they done away with their bread. They trampled down oats, they done away with their porridge. They trampled down barley, they done away with their beer. No one does away with his beard, do they?
Perish the thought. Now, we need a pause for translation from the Kentish here. When George says caterways, he means diagonally across the field. And when he says foraker, or foreacre, he means the edge of the field which is left unploughed, what's called a headland in some parts of the country.
A recurring theme throughout here was Michael's idea for a twinning freedom, built on his friendship with Madame Claudie Chèvre in the Ballet de la Corse, just over the channel. By December, things were happening, if in a rather disjointed way.
I found the village newsletter, which has all the news about Elam, which is fit to print, and some which isn't, found it on the doormat. Idly leafing through it, I suddenly uttered a not particularly muffled oath and scurried breathlessly to next door but one to catch my friend, Parish Councillor Derek Borton. He was just getting into the bath, but this was no time for trifling.
I want a word with you.
Oh, yes.
Yes. I have here in my hand a copy of the Elam newsletter.
Yes.
It contains the proceedings of the parish council, as you will no doubt see. And about four items down, I'll read what it says. It says, twinning. A positive response had been received from neighbouring councils to this council's suggestion for a twinning link between the Elam Valley and an area in France. It was agreed that the next step should be the formation of a committee to develop the project further. Can you tell me anything about this? You were present at the meeting, I take it.
I was present at the meeting. I'm not sure that I can tell you much, Michael. Except I think that you are in line to be the chairman and convener and etc.
That's what I was very much afraid of.
Have you not had any communication?
As a matter of fact, no. The first thing I knew of it was reading it in the village newsletter.
It's very bad, really, isn't that way?
Yes. Can you tell me what was said at the meeting?
We've been in touch with Barham and with Liminge, and I think Kingston. And I think that all of them were moderately interested at any rate, yes. So that it looks as though it's a possibility, provided we've got the man to set the whole thing in motion.
Well, I tell you what I will do. I will convey this news, which is actually, let's face it, very good news, because it's not indifference. I will convey this news to my opposite number in France, Madame Chèvre, and, well, it looks as if we may be set on a course that I little thought would come about.
Could be, yes.
Well, it did go ahead, thanks to the enthusiasm of many, including André Slatten. But sadly, like another European project, it's now part of history.
Thank you, Derek. So, that concludes our evening. We hope you've enjoyed the mix of memories, anecdotes and extracts about 100 years of radio and connections to Elam. A big thank you again to Brian and Richard for their technical work, literally behind the scenes, and to our panel, Pam, Derek, Nigel and Trevor, for their contributions. As we started this part of the evening with the way Radio 4 began the day, we feel it's appropriate to conclude with the way Radio 4 closed down each night. Thank you for listening.
But for now, it's time for me to dim the lights and say farewell as I head off home. This is Arlene Fleming on behalf of everyone here at Broadcasting House, wishing you a safe and a very peaceful night. Good night.
Thank you.